Hello there, and welcome to the May edition of the Lancet HIV podcast. I'm the journal's editor, Peter Hayward. This month, I'm delighted to be joined by Adam Castillejo, who is at the centre of an article published recently online and included in the May issue of the Lancet HIV. Adam, also known as the London patient, is the second person ever to have been cured of HIV after a stem cell transplant. I'm going to be speaking to Adam about his remarkable story. Hi, Adam. Thank you for joining me.
Hi, Peter. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. When you first diagnosed with HIV, how did you feel at that point living with HIV? Sort of, did you find acceptance when you revealed to people that you were living with HIV?
So, do you mean when I was diagnosed? When I was diagnosed back in the noughties?
Yes.
I was diagnosed in 2003. We just live in the 90s. And the 90s was a very turbulent time for the HIV crusade, as we say. So in the 90s, it was a death sentence. We just came out from the 80s, and in the 90s, it was just a progression from the 80s. So when we turn to the noughties, it's still you fear as an ultimate diagnose. And from in my how I felt, for me, it was like a death sentence because, you know, it was very close to the 90s to be told you can live a healthy life for the next 10 years, and we hope you can live to more 20 years. So that was a very challenging and overwhelming experience. It's a death sentence when somebody give you to that at that time. Yeah. Nowadays, it's a very different outlook. I think people now have better treatment, retroviral medication, and better outlook to life. You can live a healthy life and, you know, normal life, bracket, normal. But in the early noughties, it was a very different picture. We were just coming out from the 90s. And in my case, I felt, you know, streaming with well. I thought I was going to die. There's not much hope. I'm going to die anytime soon because you still have the reference for the AIDS pandemic when people had diagnosed you will die quite soon. So it was a very scary time for me. And I was lucky enough to have a partner at the time would accept me no matter what, and they embraced me. And that was one of the key factors for me to kind of endure and say, oh, I can, let's be happy, let's embrace my life, and let's do the best I can do, let's be healthy. Prior to that, I was already like anybody in the 20s, you know, a healthy person, you know, a healthy guy, young man. Working, sports, training, you know, like, I've always been very active through my life. So I like sports, cycling, running, swimming. So I've always been a very sporty person. So for me, it was kind of reinforcing me at that time, reinforcing my belief to live a healthy life.
Right. Was that easy to do after you got the diagnosis of HIV? I mean, obviously, that was a shock. But once you'd accepted the reality of having HIV, did you find it sort of easy to, were you able to maintain your activity and your sportiness and your training and all that?
Yeah, I think when that happened, it's like you have to grieve that diagnosed. That if, you know, you have a period of grief, and then you move on from that. The acceptance,
yeah,
of your diagnosis. I think that's very important. A lot of people struggle with that, and in that time in the early noughties, it was still, as I say before, it was still the 90s. Yeah. It was very difficult even for the medical doctors and nurses and the care workers still telling you, reinforcing and giving you that hope. They were very cautious about how hopeful they want to be. They want to be very kind to you, but they were kind of the fact. You know, the your life spans can last 10 years or maximum 20 years, and that's a wonderful life to live. So that was kind of the outlook when I was diagnosed. So, and I said to myself, well, it took a while, I have to be honest. It's something you don't just recover instant. It took us quite a while for me to recover and to accept my diagnosis. And then later on, I said, well, I can't let this to damper my spirit. And that reinforced me to eat well, continue to live my life, to live to the fullest. I think that was important to do at that time. Not everyone can do that. I was very lucky enough to have all the medications and all the things available here in London, which all the people around the world now, they are not that lucky or they have that privilege, because sometimes I feel like we here in Europe, we have privilege compared to all the part of the world. They don't have the same amount of resources to get medications. And to live a healthy life, you have to go into medications to have, you know, to maintain your life. I think that was something which had been progressing through the years compared to when I was diagnosed. I think it was more tragic and more horror when I was diagnosed, when you were diagnosed today. So that would be different. It's a huge...
Yeah, certainly there's the treatments are better now, and access around the world is, while definitely not perfect, greatly improved. So obviously you've been living with HIV for a while, and then you were diagnosed with another very serious disease. Can you tell us about that and how that affected you?
Before the diagnosis, I was, I live a healthy lifestyle. You know, working, training. I always be very cautious about my well-being and the training. I really look after myself and eat well. And because I'm as a chef myself, it was unable to kind of eat well. Mm-hmm. And I keep training, I keep looking at, and then that happens. Unfortunately, I have to kind of relieving the death sentence I have when I have the HIV. It was kind of similar, but this time it have a more definite and more immediate effect. You can die really quickly compared to when I have the HIV diagnosis, when you can die quickly too, but you had a outlook about 10 or 20 years. This time around, you can die in very short periods of time, because a cancer patient can die very quickly. Some people die 2 days or 3 days after being diagnosed. So it's a very scary place to be. I felt, wow, I couldn't believe it. It was happening to me. What have I done? I questioned myself and thinking, what have I done wrong to deserve this? Again, I felt, well, Adam, is this what you need to go through? You go through, and let's face it head on. And that's what I did. But it was kind of relieving all the emotion. But at the same time, you feel numb, because it's a very scary scenario. And you have to, and again, because I think when you have the HIV, you are apprehensive about all the HIV treatment. And then you go apprehensive when you have the chemotherapy treatment. And you don't know what is going to happen. You don't know the side effects. You have no idea. It's a lot of uncertainty when you embark this. But I have kind of that spirit, sadly, from the HIV early in the 90s. So I able to navigate better that aspect. But it was very scary. I was petrified of dying, like anybody who has an early cancer today. It's a very scary situation. If extremely overwhelming, you're thinking, my God, I'm going to die.
And the diagnosis, it was acute myeloid leukemia, was it, that you had?
No, I did not have leukemia. I have a stage lymphoma.
Okay.
It's a blood cancer. I think that was one of the things people still to confuse between me and Timothy Brown. Timothy have a leukemia, I have lymphoma.
Right.
They both have, they're blood cancers.
Oh, yeah. So you have Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Yeah, it's stage 4.
Yeah. So you were diagnosed with stage 4 Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Yes, correct.
So that must have been...
Yeah, extremely overwhelming, because, you know, people think it's stage 1, it's stage 2, it's stage 3, but mine was straight to stage 4. So suddenly I became very ill, ill. And I thought I was going to die.
But it seems like...
Because I was extremely ill, but I was deteriorating very rapidly.
Yeah.
Back when I was my diagnosis, it was touch and go, if we can say. I felt like I was going to die.
But then once you began treatment for the Hodgkin's lymphoma, you suggested it before that perhaps the experience with HIV had given you some sort of resilience and ability to sort of cope with the treatment, and that's...
Yes, it can give you some resilience, but it was a very different topic. I think when you have the HIV, you have medication and you have in control. You regular control yourself, checkups, but with cancer, you have no control whatsoever. The narrative is a very different one. But at the same time, you are overwhelmed by what you have to endure compared when you had an HIV diagnosis. It's a very different prospect.
So then down the line, you're receiving treatment for... You're receiving treatment, but how did you come to be involved in the attempt to cure your HIV?
It is important to remind everyone to get involved with this. It happened a very many years on the line. So I was around 2011, and we're talking about in 2015. So we're talking about several years. I had to endure chemotherapy regimes, disappointing results, and having people seem to don't realize that there was something it's important for me to emphasize and clarify. From 2011 to 2015, I was enduring in a regular basis chemotherapy regimes. Endure month after month, year after year, non-stop chemotherapy regimes. I had to face the reality of my mortality. It was nothing I came across in 2015, but my will to not to give up in life. You have to remember a lot of people who has currently suffered from cancer, who are HIV patients, a lot of treatments are not available to them because it's not a lot of medical expertise how to deal with cases. You have to bear in mind, when you have a cancer diagnosed and you are HIV, you have to make sure your retroviral medication doesn't interact with your chemotherapy regime to be able to be efficient to cure your cancer. So that's very complex, and people need to be aware that it's a very complex task for any medical clinician in the HIV world and the cancer world. That's a very complex way to go. In my case, I have been fortunate to have Professor Simon Edwards, who was able to liaise with my medical team for oncology and hematology to liaise how to be efficient with my retroviral medication, which was changing, ever changing. As my cancer, it was becoming more aggressive and the chemotherapy, it was not working. It was important to change, constant change of retroviral medications to work with that. It's a very complex situation. It's not hard to take very unlikely that when I was involved, I think that was an effort, a personal effort to find somebody willing to take that risk, to have some hope, because I was being a very hopeful person, but at the same time, very skeptical and critical about things. Yeah. So at the time when I was giving a terminal diagnosis in 2015, I decided to look elsewhere and to see all the avenues and opportunities, not only in the UK, around the world, to see what can be done. I was just deciding to take the lead in my case. I'm thinking I need to take some ownership and more control of it to see what else I can be done with my life, because I didn't want to die in a hospice, just resigned to a hospice palliative care. I'd rather die fighting than that. But that was an effort from my support network, who were willing to help me to find different medical teams across London and across the world who are willing to even to consider as a second opinion what can be done in my case. And yeah. I was very fortunate enough to find the consultant Ian Gabriel. He was willing to take the risk on my case. Bearing in mind, it's very complex and people need to understand this. Not every clinician will take the risk to have a transplant. Yeah. And I was fortunate enough to have a wonderful medical team at Hammersmith Hospital in London to able to give me that second chance. And it turned out it was another opportunity because they're working in the field of cancer and HIV. And they knew about the Timothy case and they were always hoping. And I was always aware of some other people behind me and in front of Timothy, after Timothy has passed away, he hasn't been successful. I was aware of that. But the main thing, it was to cure my cancer. And yeah. I always knew for the very beginning about the I could have a CCFI mutation. And that was something I was really willing to take. No doubt, that was my only option. Yeah. My other option, it was going to hospice. So after I gained Vogue, you know, in the beginning, I was not fully aware of the stance of what I was going to become and what I was going to be involved. And then I started to, and then the doctors are telling me, explain to me what's going to happen and how wonderful this opportunity it is. Yeah. But always remain cautious about expectations. One of the things, you have to be cautious about expectations, because if you expect too high, if you fail, unless you are more skeptical and more pragmatic in your approach, then you can reach that hope.
Right. So it sounds like at the time of you coming up to your stem cell transplant, you were very aware and very well informed about the possibilities, what the different outcomes of the procedure could be. Was it for you a scary or a hopeful time?
As I say, I mean, to have an 80% chance of dying, that's a high, high percentage. I was petrified, scared, but at the same time, I have no other option. Yeah. And I have to embrace it once again. That's one of the things I always am able to kind of head on and embrace it. Doesn't mean I'm scared and I'm petrified and terrifying of the outcome, but at least I try. If I die, as I say to myself, at least you die trying. Mm-hmm. And that was my spirit saying to me, just try and hope for the best. But it was a very overwhelming experience for not only for me, I think for my family and my friends. They hope the best for me, and they have seen me for so many years struggle with cancer. They want to be happy for me. They want to do the best for me. They want to everything to be successful. But then we've been so disappointed throughout the years. You know, we have to remain skeptical and cautious.
Yeah. I mean, there must have been sort of such a huge mixture of emotions for you and your loved ones at that time. You know, it's hard to comprehend for someone who's not been through that. And so obviously you had the procedure and you knew about the possibilities. The procedure seemed to work from the point of view of treating the cancer.
Yeah. Correct.
How did you feel? Obviously, that's a massive relief to you. And as you said, the main point in the procedure was to cure the cancer. How did you then feel as time went on and you were having follow-up and it seemed that the HIV had gone as well?
Yeah, so it's important to clarify, when I have a transplant, I think I was fully aware, and it was a big part of the transplant, how to do the HIV part as well. So we don't think it was just to have a transplant and we forgot about the HIV. No, it was, and that was together. So I have a team of doctors working around the clock to find out what medication I should have to take, how I'm able to take the medication, because it was very important for me to maintain the continuity to take the retroviral medication throughout my transplant. A very challenging way to do it. I recall one of the lead doctors in one of the hospitals, he came and said, oh my God, I never seen somebody so, how important you must be. I have more than 14 clinicians and pharmacists talking about your medication. It's very overwhelming. I said, it's a pleasure to meet you. And that was kind of, that's what tells you, it was behind the scenes. The HIV was working beside the transplant. And I was always fully aware of the importance to maintain, to take my medication. That was really important for everyone around me, and the responsibility to science. Because for that point, even I knew I had a transplant, but I knew my responsibility to science. I want this to work. And I'm thinking, if I can't get cured once, I can cure of the other one, why not? Why I should jeopardize that prospect? So I understood my responsibility to the scientific community and to myself as well. I think that was a chance for me to get cured. And saying that, I don't want to ever people think I was fortunate, I was lucky enough, I was in the right place and the right time. That's really important to people to understand. It's not to be privileged. It's a privilege to be in this position right now. But at that time, I was in the right place and the right time. So it's important for that. So throughout, and going back to one your questions about the process, after the transplant, we were in a constant monitor to this day, and I continue monitor in a very regular basis to check that. After a year, when we decide to consider the possibility to stop medication, that was a very, how can I say, it's a situation in reverse from my diagnosis, because I was petrified to be once again HIV positive.
Yeah.
You are thinking in reverse, oh my God, I'm going to be from HIV positive to HIV negative. Obviously, as any human being would be a desire or to get cured. And that anybody can tell you that desire to be cured. And at that point, when I was aware we have to take medication and that we have to embark in the journey of not taking medication and the constant monitor to realize if this actually worked on that aspect of the HIV and the CCR5 mutation worked effectively, it was very scary. And I decided to, and I have very important, I decided to take the medication on my birthday, on a very symbolic day to stop medication, because I thought it's something I want to give to myself. And one better present to myself is to stop medication on my birthday. And I did that. And then we embarked in the situation when they stopped medication a week later, negative, the next 2-4 nights negative, a month negative, and the time goes. Obviously, we both, the medical team and myself and I, we were cautious. We were happy, but remained cautious because of the failings in the past. So we were very cautious. And I think managing expectation is very important at that stage. And I think when the time passed, 6 months, then a year, then we start looking more positive, and we kind of realized, oh, we have something good going on.
Yeah.
But it took several, it was no instant. I think the medical team and I would be very, very positive. We've always been very looking at the positive outlook, but always being cautious.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Does each subsequent follow-up when you're off treatment, so obviously, you know, it's now been well over 2 years.
Nearly three, I'm happy.
Is it 3 years?
Yeah, it's going to be nearly 3 years. We are more than 30. Yeah, than 30. Yeah,
yes, actually, yeah, of course. Yeah, so well, we're now getting, you know, you're approaching 3 years of treatment. What is the feeling like at each follow-up when you receive the news that there's still no detectable HIV?
I think it was a very, as I said, early stage, when it was the first time, the first month, the first several months. I was very apprehensive every time with the test. Professor Gupta designed a new machine in Cambridge University to actually find out the authenticity and the effectiveness of the HIV test. And yeah, obviously we were very cautious and very excited, and I was very apprehensive every time. But then it eased away every time. It was negative, 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 negative. It's nothing. But you start believing, oh, this is a positive way, and this is looking good. Building my expectations in later on. Yeah, I think with that, building the expectations slowly.
Yeah.
Slowly, step by step. And then after a year, we realized we are in a good place. And then it was about the London patient and then going to last year at Croix. That's when I start understanding the more the relevance and the importance of how the new steps of this journey will is. Because as always, my medical team is always the main focus is about my well-being and my welfare, and make sure physically and mentally I'm well enough to embrace. Yeah. After all, I have a transplant, and any transplantee can tell you it's a very challenging way of living. You have to live a post-transplant life, which remains. You have to be cautious. You have to obviously try to live your life the best you can, enjoy life. But you always have to remember you have a transplant. So that always is in the back of your mind. And as I say, after a year, and then when we are approaching last year at Croix, I start asking myself, where is all the, I become more and more, I think that the time goes, I become more and more involved in my case, in my care, and understanding the ins and outs about the treatment, about what had been happening, not only from the medical perspective, but then, as I say, with Timothy, but the other side, for the patient perspective. And I think after a year, and then I start asking questions about my, how we're going to call it cure. And I think, as you know, cure in the medical world is a very emotional word.
Yeah.
It has people, the clinicians around the world don't tend to like to use the word cure. I think beginning we were using functionally cure.
Yeah.
And I think that was a more cautious way to define cure. And I think now we are more into a different stage. We call it now operationally cure. So that's important for me to have the knowledge. And I think now I am more aware of then what's happening. And I continue to work with Professor Gutta. I volunteer myself to do research. So I donate blood to different research in gene therapy. And I think that's very important to continue helping the scientific community. And I want to do that. And I feel, as a, once again, responsibility to the science and to the millions of people around the world who are living and fear of HIV, and as well to be a voice of the people who have is not with us. So I feel very passionate about that.
I thought I'd just ask you about your decision to reveal your identity and what prompted that, if that's okay.
Yeah, I think that beginning in 2015, when I was given this amazing opportunity to have cured my cancer, but as well my HIV. And that's when the London patient kind of born at that time. I thought at the time I was have to concentrate on my health because cancer, I was in imminent danger to die. So I think my main focus at that time, it was concentrating on my cancer. I think all my medical teams, they were very exciting. At the same time, for me, it was a very exciting prospect to, I could never imagine in my lifetime will ever endure or imagine to be cured of HIV because what we live in for the last decade. So I embarked on this journey at that time, but I think my concentration at that period, it was about my recuperation to go through my transplant. But after the transplant, and things seemed to go well, relatively well, I started understanding the relevance and the importance of my story and what it means to people all around the world. And I understood this story, it just be on me. It would be very selfish of me not to tell my story to people and give hope. I think that's one of the things that resonated with me. It was, I need to give hope to people. It's a possibility. Obviously, we need to be very clear about the way I was cured. That's something it cannot be replicated easily, feasible, and costly, and it's highly risky. And this has to be only be taken when you have a cancer diagnosed, and your only way is having a transplant. So at that time, I thought, well, I believe this is very difficult for people, and I think a lot of people struggle mentally and physically about the HIV diagnosis. For me, it would be important, and I feel very humbled to be in this position, and I felt that it would be selfish, once again, of me not to reveal my story and to tell people, yes, it's a hope and it's a light in the end of the tunnel.
That's great. Thank you.
Very difficult. It's not something I took time for me to think about it. And it was something I had to consider because I had to see the pros and cons.
And did you, when you were thinking about revealing your identity, did you consider what Timothy Brown had gone through as well, the Berlin patients?
What happened to Timothy Brown is, I think, is my blueprint, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, if I only can be referred and I only can have reference to him. So for me, it was start to understand his journey from my perspective and, you know, to how it can be related to it and understand the difficulties he experienced throughout his coming out as a people tend to call it, and to reveal your identity. I think it was a blueprint for me to understand, and I tried to get some advice and guidance from him because I was the only person I can relate to.
Yeah. So you did speak to him about it?
Yes, I did. I did. For several months, we engaged in conversations to kind of for him to let me know and for me to have an understanding, because bearing in mind, we are two strangers we find to be united by an amazing story. And we are, and I was very delighted and very very touched when he was asked last year when my story, The London Patient, came to life. He said, one of the wonderful things he said, welcome to the family. And that was very, very reassuring for me. And for him, I think that was very, very special. That bond, we instant bond we have.
Yeah, to go from being the only person in the world to then having someone who's shared that experience must be, you know.
Yeah, and that's a very special and unique bond we have. And we value and share that. We continue talking and we still in touch, and we still, I think, this brotherhood, because I think I recall when he said, welcome to the family, hello, big hug to my brother. I thought that was very, very kind, and I that was really special to me, and it meant a lot to me.
Yeah.
Not to feel alone, because I for him, as you say, for him to be alone for so long time, to find somebody who can actually relate, because he couldn't relate to anyone. I've been fortunate enough to able to relate to someone. So for me, I was kind of supporting and say, I understand where you're coming from, and nobody else could. So either way, he could actually feel, oh, somebody can relate to me as well. So it's very special. Yeah.
So that is, I mean, one of the things that you've done over the past few months, and particularly since your coming out, to use that phrase, is that you've really sort of embraced your position as an advocate. So, and I just wonder, what is the message that you would most like to use your platform to convey?
You know, you mentioned about advocate, and people tend to go and say advocate or activist. I prefer to use the word ambassador of hope, because that gives me more, amplify my message to give hope to people with cancer, because I always have to remember I'm in this position because of my cancer treatment, and I cannot let that to be diminished by any means or form. And I think I would like to advocate many causes, but I prefer to use the ambassador of hope, because that gives me more, I can amplify my message. Because I think that what I want to do is give it hope. And obviously, I want to advocate to many causes, not only for the HIV world, I'm going to do other cancer world. And one of the things where people seem to miss out and if on what happened is your mental health. And it's very important to look after your mental health, because that's a key factor in your well-being during both cancer or HIV. Your well-being is a major factor. And I think that's what I want to, not only you being an advocate, I want to amplify and broaden my horizons to have a wider approach. And I sympathize and empathize with a lot of people, no matter your gender, color, race. That's what I want to do. And I feel, once again, very passionate. And that's what I want to do.
Well, thank you, Adam. It's been absolutely fascinating and inspiring. And yeah, humbling to speak to you today. I think this is going to be of great interest to our readers. And I'm really grateful for your participation in this recording today.
The pleasure is mine, Peter. I think I'm very honored you asking me to do this interview. And I think it's important to raise awareness and give hope. And I think people can relate. For me, it's very important people relate to me and feel like you're not alone in this journey. You don't feel alone. And the way I feel, the scared, sadness, happiness, that roller coaster emotions is normal. It happened to anybody who are dealing with this right now.
Yeah.
Know very well how challenging it is, and it's still a lot of discrimination and stigma attached. because something before I finish, I think it's important for you to know when you have HIV, you have people, you have discrimination. And when you have cancer, you have kindness. And that's something I want to readdress the balance of that. I think that's one of the things I want to, very passionate once again. I'm very keen to rebalance that, to make sure people, when you have HIV, have compassion for you too, the same way people have compassion when you have cancer.
Thank you so much for talking to us. And, you know, your message of hope is certainly one that we can all use in this current time as well. So, yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, during coronavirus, it's important to be united. And myself, which I am in self-isolation, and keeping myself safe, follow the UK guidelines. And it's important at this time, we are all together and we need to be united and help each other. I think it's important to help each other, talk to one another, and don't be afraid to ask for help. Or don't be afraid to show emotion. Don't be afraid to ask. I think at this current time, during coronavirus pandemic, it's important to feel love, to feel care, and to don't feel alone in this world. We are all here together. And thank you for having me.
Thank you so much, Adam.